This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 3rd of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 121st edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. This is a good one. Listen close, friends. On today's show, we welcome journalist and iconoclast John Savage to talk about Teenage, the film of his book that traces the roots of this misunderstood bunch. Come on, once we all were.
We had plenty of adults saying how dreadful youth were, so if we were going to explore the youth world, are these people groping towards some kind of autonomy? We needed to hear from the youth themselves.
Well, welcome back the brilliant Diane Birch, an American singer-songwriter who loves a bit of reverb.
I'm usually shouting it to just out in the open air, I would say.
Just on the
more
streets.
More reverb instead of cowbell. It's like, more reverb.
And we'll cock our ears like Nipper the HMV Jack Russell to an immersive sound exhibition in New York.
There's something very kind of melancholic about these open ears just kind of pointing out to sea. And when that ties in with the knowledge that their use withered away, it just seemed like really a great objects to repurpose.
Plus, there's a bit of an archive theme. We'll be analysing the soundtracks of Michael Caine's back catalogue. We'll meet the man who sifted through the entire collection of National Geographic's photographs for their 125th anniversary publication. And we'll take a tour around the storage rooms of Houston's Manil collection. So sit back, relax, get out your white gloves and blow the dust off your index card collection. And join me here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. And we'll swing over to the piano we've just set up here in the corner of Studio One for a track from this week's musical guest, Diane Birch. You know her, the toothsome singer-songwriter who hit us with Bible Belt 4 years ago, and she's back now with Speak a Little Louder, a new and great album. From it, here she is with Superstars.
Butterflies don't compromise my reason. Why'd you say let's haunt our history? Take me out, we'll toast the change of season. Swim the neon river to the sea. Take your time, I'm hanging on forever. You go hide and I go seek to find the clues. We could spin this world right around. Honey, we just love to sing the blues. So listen up, there's words for you. Let's go dance on Mars, we're superstars tonight. Just give it up, you know it's true. Here behind the bars, we're superstars tonight. Superstars tonight, we're superstars. Stay up late, we'll wake up even later. Just in time to watch the people going home. Simple life, you look so good on paper. They got Bowie playing on the radio. So listen up, there's words for you. We got a life on Mars, we're superstars tonight. Tonight, we're superstars. We're superstars. stars. We're superstars. We're superstars. We're superstars. Ooh, yeah.
That was Diane Birch playing Superstars from that new record, Speak a Little Louder, and we'll hear more from that later on in the show. John Savage has just co-produced and co-written a film of his book, Teenage, the subtitle of which might surprise you, The Creation of Youth, 1875 to 1945. We're looking here at the early days of post-industrial revolution lost boys, at the lost souls of two world wars being led like lambs to slaughter by the adult world, the bright young things of the 20s crashing their cars and doing serious drugs. We're looking at the music that helped the civil rights movement. We're listening to swing. There's not a scene from Happy Days in sight. John came in to talk about the film, directed by Matt Wolff. Beautiful, mesmeric film that it is.
The teenager was an American invention. It's what we wanted to be. We knew we could be blown up in an instant. So we lived in the now.
I knew that I wanted to do a film, the book, and I started work in television in 1979. So I've been making programs and films for, 35 years now. I'd had various English companies and producers not getting the idea, and Matt totally got the idea. He's young, which I wanted. Also, he's based in New York, and I very much wanted the film to be made in America because it's basically an American story. And Matt has fulfilled all my expectations and beyond. I'm incredibly pleased with what he's done.
It's quite an unusual way of putting a film together. It's got a hypnotic quality to it because it's all voiced over by actors of the age and news clips and still photography. And it's obviously been purposely put together in that style. Was that something that you wanted as well, to make sure that it kind of got the vibe of the book in that sense?
Well, of course, you approach each film in a different way. And certainly as a writer, dealing with a director, you have to let directors have their own head. It's their film, and they're the person in the editing suite making it. But Matt and I worked very closely on this, and it was a process of problem solving, really. We initially began with trying me out on various voiceovers, and I was absolutely dreadful. And also, through that, we decided that we didn't want a single authorial narrator. And we certainly didn't
want... That seems quite adult, doesn't it, when you're dealing with teenagers?
Well, exactly. And the point is that most of the footage we'd got was told from the adult's point of view. This is very important because the book is dialectic between adults trying to control youth and youth seeking some kind of autonomy. We have plenty of adults saying how dreadful youth were. So if we were going to explore the youth world, or these people groping towards some kind of autonomy, we needed to hear from the youth themselves.
Our teachers and our parents didn't understand us, so we created our own world. Youth, we're leading youth. We'd run through forests, light together bonfires, make flower wreaths and photos, sing and dance, then drop off our clothes and feel free.
They look so good, they dance so well, they've got such a lot of attitude, and you kind of want to get that across in the film. There's some quotes that stand out. The constant need, it seems to, the quote is a solution to the problem of youth, which kind of bounced out of the film at me. There seem to be a few ways that the adult world's tried to do that with the Industrial Revolution and then the wars, and these are covered quite heavily in the film, aren't they?
Well, yes, and unfortunately for me, when I was, and in fact it got to Matt as well, when we were making the film, and obviously with the historical timescale, we have to go through two world wars. And obviously, when I was researching the book, I had to go through, and they're really, it's just really upsetting. It's just really awful. I remember when I was researching World War One, I went to the Imperial War Museum for a few days. And one day I just came out and I was just sick. I was literally physically sick. I had to be sick in a bush because it's so toxic. You know, the First World War in particular is the worst thing that ever happened to this country. And it's destroyed this country. So we had to, you know, we had to go through all that, and it's tough stuff. And Matt found the Second World War, but because he's Jewish, found the Second World War very, very tough. So, yes, you do have this constant dialectic, and we very much wanted to show in the film, particularly with the recreations, with the four characters, Brenda Dean Paul, Melissa Mashman, Warren Wall, and Tommy Scheel, we wanted to take you into the teenage world. What were they thinking and feeling? It's very important, so that you got this youthful voice, and also a lot of the voiceover, which was voiced by, you know, young actors, including Ben Whishaw, was actually taken from teenage diaries, was taken from the book or contemporary sources. So you do get, you know, a proper adolescent voices from within, not somebody telling them what to think. And also, finally, about the soundtrack, both Matt and I would love to see the actual soundtrack of the film released as a CD.
That's part, I guess, of the hypnotic feel of the film, is having these archive, a lot of archive footage, presumably some of the earliest footage that's moving in black and white with some contemporary electronic music over it. Is pretty, it's a special atmosphere you get off that.
We had the original Dixieland jazz band in an early cut of the film, and that was recorded in 17 as a, you know, the first million-selling jazz record, so it's a huge record, and it really sounded bad. It sounded awful, and we couldn't do anything with it electronically too. And so the first real bit of then contemporary music, historical music, true to the time that you get is Benny Goodman Sing 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 with Gene Krupa going crazy on the drums. So we were pretty sparing with original music.
I want to tell you, I have never seen such a spectacle as this in all my life.
Swing was the voice of youth, the sound of freedom. It was real. It was alive.
Enthusiastic young jitterbugs, young Americans living for the world of tomorrow.
And there is a nice quote in there, which is kind of one of those things that sort of dates teenagerdom in some strange way. Where they go, when Benny Goodman played New York,
yes,
it went bananas.
Yes.
And I just love that. That's kind of, it's, I suppose that was the precursor to Sinatra mania and Beatlemania and all the things that came before it.
Swing culture is fascinating. And obviously, to me, when I started researching it, swing music was the music of my parents. And, you know, I hated Les Mis. I thought it was awful. But I had to completely re-examine my own prejudices and re-evaluate it because it's actually fantastically exciting. Also, it's really the moment when everything starts to come together. There had been a jazz culture in the 20s, but the youth culture at the time was mainly based on university students. What had happened in the intervening 10 years is that youth culture, commercialized youth culture, or pan-American youth culture, had developed in downwards in age to the high school years. And that's a crucial element in the spread of the teenage idea and also its democratization. And swing was very, very much a part of that. And so it really is the start of youth culture.
I just want to ask you finally if teenagers could have made this film. There's a lot of arguments for the robustness and intellect of teenagers in the movie, but you have to be your age to make a film like this, don't you?
Well, I think that the film is a product of two ages. The film is a product of me, who's just turned 60, and Matt, who's just turned 30. So Matt is half my age. We're of different generations. And that made making the film very interesting as well, because, you know, you have to communicate your ideas. You can't assume a whole set of references and everything. I think people are very complex, and I think we're a mixture of different ages all the time. Sometimes I feel 80, and sometimes I feel 20. And I'm still very much in tune with how I was when I was a teenager. It doesn't mean I want to act like it, but I can remember how I was, because it's a very, very crucial point of identity formation. That's when you start to really work out who you are and then how you're going to make it work.
One great last quote from the movie is someone, I love being 17, I wish I could stay 17 forever. There was some poetry in those teenagers, right?
Well, absolutely. That was a letter sent into the magazine 17, which was the first really major youth culture. You know, that was what blew it all wide open, really. It was fantastically successful. It was aimed at young women, and it sold something ridiculous within a few, 750,000, and everybody took up a notice. And, you know, there is that very important point, which is the origin of youth culture. The youth culture that we understand actually comes from young women. It's really important. Young women, creating this huge market for this magazine, 17, screaming at Sinatra, making this whole idea of youth culture, and particularly during the war when there weren't a lot of young men around. And I think this is often underwritten because people always talk about young men in youth culture, but there's a very important point, which is it actually begins with young women, whether anybody likes it or not.
They called us sub-debs. You'd see us all over the magazines. We weren't debutantes at all. Just regular old high school kids. But it sounded fancy. And we sure like fancy.
And that was John Savage in his new movie, Teenage, directed by Matt Wolff, is out now in UK cinemas and is being screened at festivals around the world too. Maybe a DVD is also a good way of picking it up. Whatever way you listen to it loud, because the music in it is fantastic. Teenagefilm.com is the place to go for all the details. Yes, you know that jingle. This is Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we're moving now to New York to take a listen to an intriguing new exhibition which opened recently in Brooklyn. I say take a listen because it's based around the massive sound mirrors which were built along the coast of England after the First World War. They're huge blocks of concrete or stone, about 15 feet tall, with a large round dish shape carved into them. They were used as early warning devices designed to detect the sound of approaching enemy fighter planes, but they became obsolete once radar took over in the 1930s. However, you can still see them today on England's coastline, and these objects of intrigue and beauty caught the attention of Sydney-based artist Tim Bruniges. His sound installation, Mirrors, is on now at the Signal Gallery in New York, and Pauline Eiferman went down there to meet him.
They're literally these parabolic dishes, often made out of concrete or stone, that operate, I guess, much in the same way as satellite dishes or anything else. They reflect energy, in this case, sound. And the idea was that defense personnel would be able to man these objects and literally hear aircraft approaching from out to sea. And there's something very kind of, I don't know, for me, very kind of melancholic about these open ears just kind of pointing out to sea. In this piece, which is called Mirrors, there's two of these objects that we've built, two sound mirrors, and they're identical. Because they're opposing at extreme ends of the gallery space, they form a very interesting kind of amplified acoustic situation, much akin to there's a concept of the whispering gallery, where you can whisper into one corner and someone else can stand in the opposing side and you can very clearly hear the conversation. So they operate on that level, but also in this installation, there's microphones placed in each and also two speakers in the room. So all the sound that's generated into these sound mirrors is regenerated back into the space, and through various manipulations, every bit of sound re-emerges and regenerates itself through the whole entirety of the exhibition.
How have people reacted to the show?
People seem to really want to touch them, and which is nice because It's actually very subtle the way they play out, and this is a direct reference to how they did play out as functional objects. It didn't make sense to turn this work into a big cacophonous kind of sound because that's not how they operated. There's something very nice about how they were these kind of gargantuan monolithic objects, but you had to lean in and kind of, you know, there's something very nice about that combination of engaging with them. Yes, so the basic setup of the work is that from the moment the show opens, it's an active acoustic space. So every bit of environmental sound in this space is being kind of focused into these mirrors, being picked up by microphones, acoustically being reflected through the two opposing mirrors, but also being fed back into speakers. The cycle never ends.
So depending on where you're standing in the space, you will hear something different.
That's true, yeah. In the processing of the work, like these microphones go into a computer and there's very long loops and loops of different lengths. So in a very subtle way, you could be standing here on Wednesday and hear a little segment of someone whistling from Friday last week kind of thing. So every bit of sound kind of emerges and comes and goes, and just to kind of play with that notion of how ambiguous the sound was that these objects would capture.
And that was Tim Brunages talking to Pauline Eiferman. And you can see Tim's Mirrors installation on show at the appropriately named Signal Gallery in Brooklyn until the 9th of March. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We're blowing the bloody doors off next.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Alfie, The Ipcress File, The Italian Job, Get Carter. Michael Caine's film back catalogue is familiar to most by name, but what if someone played you a song from one of those soundtracks? Would you instantly know which film it was, or even recognise it? Well, an event taking place this week at London's Barbican is attempting to showcase some of this music to a wider audience and help it gain some of the recognition it rightly deserves. Blow the Bloody Doors Off, which will feature the whole Get Carter soundtrack in full, alongside excerpts from other scores and a few film clips too, is the creation of musical director Terry Edwards. He stopped by Midori House to talk me through a few of these musical masterpieces.
Is that my B107, sir?
As if you didn't know. And it makes awful reading, Palmer. You just love the army, don't you?
Oh, yes, sir. I just love the army, sir.
The Cockney chappie that people do the impersonations of most is probably the Caine of The Italian Job.
Yeah.
Blow the Bloody Doors Off. There you go, I've got it in first. But it's actually Quincy Jones who wrote all the music, and it's Don Black who did the lyrics, but it's quite strange to think there's Quincy doing the Self-Preservation Society.
He
wrote that sort of that tune we all associate with the British laddishness, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but that one has the most lush kind of strings and things in it, and the big Matt Munro song in it as well, of course, on days like these that opens it all up.
How much do you think the success of these soundtracks is predicated on one song like that? Because obviously Alfie, was that Scylla?
That's strange because that's tacked on at the end. It's not part of the Sonny Rollins thing,
okay.
And it was written by Bacharach and David.
Of course it was, yeah.
So it's actually, that's a bit of an anomaly, that one.
I think we should have a blast of something. We mentioned Sonny Rollins' work for Alfie. I think we should have a bit of that to get our listeners in the vibe.
Absolutely.
And that was the main theme from Alfie by Sonny Rollins. And that kind of, I guess I feel kind of like I'm there right now.
Yeah, it's that happy-go-lucky thing.
Yeah, it is. And it's that I'm kind of expecting now Michael Caine to break the fourth wall and turn to the camera and speak one of his monologues like he does in them.
Yes,
so,
yeah.
Right. I guess we're going to rewind to talk about John Barry's work for the Ipcress Farm. Mm-hmm. One of my favourite films, this as well. And a very kind of, a different kind of film. It was a spy film. Yeah. Harry Palmer was very different to James Bond. But John Barry obviously scored both movies. What are the differences you see between the work he did for this film and his Bond stuff?
It is a smaller group for Ipcress Farm. Mm. There's some very interesting voicings. I'm going to get very muso on you here. There's a couple of flutes that take a lot of the harmonies with the muted trumpet solos in it. And I'm not sure who plays the trumpet on it, because I think John Barry was a trumpet player himself. That's his instrument, as it were. It's quite interesting because there are lots of gaps sonically. There's low brass things and then higher flutes, and often not a huge amount in the middle. So it pins a lot of things together, and you feel it's a bit of a house of cards. It could fall apart at any minute. But it also has that immense hammer dulcimer sound in it. That's the thing that I was going to ask you, what is that sound?
Let's give our listeners a bit of the Ipcress Farm. This is one of the most amazing sounds in music, and I always feel like it sounds a bit like a harpsichord being thrown out of a window.
Thing that isn't a harpsichord is a hammer dulcimer with a shed load of reverb on it. Yeah,
it's beautiful. This is John Barry's theme for the Ipcress Farm.
You hear what I mean there, that it could fall apart at any minute because it doesn't have a thick arrangement there. You can hear every instrument individually. It's just sitting inside your ear, isn't it?
It is. There's a kind of virtuosity to everything being played there, right? Everyone sort of feels like they're playing for themselves almost, and it's kind of hanging together. Yeah. But there's a well-scored arrangement. Mm-hmm. It was just done in that kind of free, that floating way.
Yeah.
It's things like that, and that was my favourite of the lot, actually, I have to say. Mm-hmm. I love the movie and I love that soundtrack to it. But there is something in there that says spy to us just as much as a James Bond score does.
Yeah, there is something enigmatic about that melody, isn't there? You know, it's probably the devil's interval, isn't it? The flatted fifth,
right.
Beloved of all jazz players. Yeah. I think it's that gets alluded to quite a lot.
And what about Get Carter? How come that gets the full nine yards.
I think, in a sense, and everyone does know Get Carter and, you know, loves it. It's a bit of a cult movie and everything. But the soundtrack itself, a lot of that music isn't used in the film. It's only used to punctuate very small parts. And it's, again, film is very bleak, the filming of it, and the plot is rules the film. Mm. and Kane's masterful performance in it. And I just thought it would be quite good to have the music centre stage for, you know, think, hang on a minute, this is better than you think it is, you know.
Sure thing. Well, it's the work of Roy Budd, and here he is. This is some of the stuff he did for Get Carter. And that was Get Carter from Roy Budd. Listening to that without the images in front is quite instructive. I suppose it's echoing in there. You can't quite work out whether it's traffic noise or waves crashing on a beach.
Yeah.
I suppose that's where the movie sort of starts and ends, isn't
it? That's, in fact, the train going from London to Newcastle.
It's a fascinating thing. And I wonder whether you feel that soundtracks of this era, maybe just for these movies, and maybe just because they are such iconic bits of music, they have a life of their own without the film, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't know how many contemporary film soundtracks or music composed for films, I should say, not mm-hmm. the songs and stuff that people stick into films,
right,
have that same sort of resonance without the images in front of your face. Do you know what I mean?
Possibly so, yeah. I mean, I think underscoring is different these days. I think it's something that it's a bit of a lost tradition.
And that was musical director Terry Edwards, whose events Blow the Bloody Doors Off is happening this week at London's Barbican. You can get your tickets from barbican.org.uk. And how many times that night do you think you'll hear, "You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off"? Still to come in part two, more of this week's session from Diane Birch's long-awaited second album. We'll hear how National Geographic is celebrating its 125th anniversary and pour through the hidden gems in the back rooms of Houston's Manil collection. Wham bam, thank you ma'am. So first, back to the wonderful Diane Birch. She'll charm you, I'm sure, when you hear her explain her obsession with reverb. But first off, here she is with All the Love You Got.
I said, I wonder where you've gone. Have you found a head to crown that stays under when you push it down? I said, I wonder what went wrong. Was I too emotional? Too many puzzles for your simple soul. She lets you sleep when she's awake. Does she close her eyes and pay the asking price? Does she suffer with a smile? Take a penny for a soul that's a heart of loneliness. Drinks the honey of your promises. Does she know that's all the love you've got? That's all the love you've got. Does she know that's all the love you've got? Tell me, does it feel the same? Is she close enough to her? When she takes it, does it make it worse? It'll kill a perfect day with a twinkle in your eye. Do you steal away when she's asleep? Does she close her eyes, pay the asking price? Does she suffer with a smile? Take a penny for a soul that's a heart of loneliness. Drinks the honey of your promises. Does she know that's all the love you've got? That's all the love you got. When she lets you lead the way.
Diane Birch, thank you so much for coming on The Culture Show.
Thank you for having me.
You've got to excuse me saying this, there's quite a while between Bible Belt, your first LP, and the second one. What happened? It's quite a different sounding record. Did you have to rootle around in lots of boxes to find inspiration? What happened?
I mean, there's so many things that happened, and there's so many reasons why it took such a long time. I mean, I think that after the first album, as much as I was proud of it, and I felt like I was very pigeonholed in a certain category. Yeah. And there were so many other things of my musical interest that I just didn't have a chance to express. And so in wanting to make a completely different record, I had to really experiment a lot. There was a lot of trial and error working with a lot of different people. Some things worked, some things didn't. It's really hard to talk about what kind of record you want to make when you haven't made it. And I'm like, it's going to be like this, and it's going to be like that, and a little disco and a little new wave, but then it's going to still have this and blah, blah, blah. And people are like, I don't get it.
So it's come out and it's a bit lusher than Bible Belt. There's more going on with it. The first was it was a kind of songwriting masterclass, that first record, I guess.
Yeah.
It was quite clear and clean.
Exactly. I mean, with this one, I was really inspired by just a lot of just production. I was really inspired by, Nile Rodgers and even somebody like Giorgio Moroder, even though you probably don't get that as much on the record. That was the one part of the vision.
Is that the hidden track?
The hidden track is like the arpeggio track, dance disco track.
And that's an interesting thing, because you kind of go, well, I was listening to this album, that album when I was making things. But it's interesting to focus on the production.
Yeah, and I'm so into the sonic quality of records. And I think a lot of times when you're a girl and you sing and you play piano and you have brown hair, people are like, oh, it's just about the songs and the vocals. And I'm like, yeah, but it's not. It's actually, for me, it's about like the whole thing. And, you know, sometimes it's not just about my voice. It's about the sound. I want it to kind of make me feel a certain way. And so, yeah, and I was listening to a lot of just kind of more adult contemporary music of
adult contemporary music.
Adult like contemporary, which I personally think is like where it's at.
What's adult contemporary music? I like that. It sounds like a soundtrack to a slightly dirty film.
I know. Well, anything that says adult contemporary, like I instantly see like cursive handwriting and like cigarette smoke and red lipstick, which, you know, I'm a fan. Yeah, no, adult contemporary. I mean, modern adult contemporary, I'm not so into, but, you know, I think of adult contemporary as like Phil Collins and Peter Gabriel. Yeah. And it's like adult rock, you know, and it's actually like all the stuff that I really love. And I love the production and, you know, a lot of Bruce Springsteen stuff, some of that 80s and even like 80s Fleetwood Mac. There was just like this lush quality. It just felt very adult, but it also felt like very rich sonically. And people were, you know, and a lot of times too, I mean, the sonic quality of records back then was usually there was like analog and people were suddenly discovering digital stuff and like keyboards and synths and all that stuff. So there was still a lot of musicality and people knew how to play their instruments and there was still a live element to it. But then it was a lot of programming and a lot of experimenting with kind of new technology. So I guess I was inspired by a lot of that and the layering of all those elements.
Yeah. And you mentioned a couple of artists there that would be kind of famous for their phrasing and their drumming. And there's a lot of echo on your voice on this record, which is kind of nice, which sounds quite retro to me. You know, it's got kind of that feel to it. It's got a big production to it. But it's got...
Yeah, the amount of times I say reverb in a day is just off the charts. I mean, I do
you
love
you say reverb,
word.
I say echo, because I'm not a musician. Okay.
Echo, well, echo. Yeah, exactly. But I'm always like, it's just a bit dry. Can you make it just wider and bigger? And
that's the sort of nitty-gritty stuff. Presumably, you come into the studio with your songs, and then it's working out the bits and bobs and the fine-tuning. That's when you're like, give me some more reverb.
Yeah.
Who are you shouting that to? Let's reenact that moment. Who are you shouting that to?
I'm usually shouting it to just out in the open air, I would say.
Just on the
more
streets.
More reverb instead of cowbell. It's like, more reverb. That'd be me, like, sort of commanding this. The thing I didn't tell you is that I actually recorded the entire thing in a parking garage, so that I could get that natural
That's
echo.
What I love. I think this was kind of recorded on the road, or certainly lots of different places, the new record, right?
Well, it was. I mean, I recorded some stuff here in the UK, some in LA. I went to Atlanta to do some stuff. I mean, there was just I was flying around a lot, doing a lot of different things. We ended up recording mostly in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and Homer Steinweiss, who I recorded most of it with. They sadly just had to close it, but this amazing analog studio in South Williamsburg. So that's where I did most of it.
And doing it in that analog way, does that affect the sort of spirit, not just the sound of the record, obviously, which is presumably why you do it, but does it affect the recording process? The sort of atmosphere is different doing it that way, and it informs the songwriting or your performance of it.
Oh, completely. Yeah, totally. I mean, the song Speak a Little Louder, that came about completely by accident. I mean, there's so many things that are like accident where we're like, what is that on the tape? Like, oh, that piano part, that shouldn't be there. And then we're like, wait a minute, it works. And nice. If you're in Pro Tools or whatever, you're just like, oh, blah, 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 you just take that out. But when things are on tape, you're kind of, you have to commit to things. And Speak a Little Louder, it was originally like a totally different song. And then suddenly we just pulled the faders down on something and listened to the drums. And I was like, oh, I like the drums. And then I layered something on top of that. But it would have never happened that way had we not recorded to tape.
That was the delightful Diane Birch. Her latest album, Speak a Little Louder, is out now in the US and Japan and will be with the rest of us in May. If you can't wait that long, she's got a little tour coming up in March too. DianeBirch.com is the place where you'll find all the information. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. National Geographic, that mighty stalwart of the magazine world, is celebrating its 125th anniversary. And to commemorate this milestone, they've teamed up with German publisher Taschen to release a huge 3-volume book which features the very best pictures that have ever appeared in the magazine's pages over the last century and a quarter. National Geographic, around the world in 125 years, is an encyclopedia for art fanatics eager to travel back through time and pore over images from the likes of Steve McCurry, Franz Lanting, and other world-class artists and journalists whose work is featured in the magazine. Our New York bureau chief, Santiago Tarditi, met with the book Geographic's editor, Ruel Golden, who was in charge of going through the National Geographic's archives and selecting the images that made it onto the page.
In terms of the depth of their archive, it's unparalleled in photography. And we felt that the combination of our production and aesthetic and ability to produce beautiful books would work very well with National Geographic, who have this incredible content. It's really the history of the 20th century to a certain extent. It's the history of our planet. And the National Geographic photographers were really top of their game right from the beginning of the magazine. And so it was a kind of dream collaboration for us.
Take me through the process of actually making the book. Were you personally going to the archives and looking through dozens of boxes of files and old pictures?
The vintage archive is about 11 million plus images. And that doesn't include stuff that was taken probably after the 60s or 70s. So it's really a bottomless pit of pictures. So for us, the challenge is firstly finding the stuff and also telling the story in a different way. So I repeatedly went to the archive trying to find pictures that somehow would develop the narrative of what we were trying to convey. But also what I did is I went through every story ever published in the National Geographic. For them, it was also a challenge because it's the first time they've got an outside publisher to roam their archive and to have the freedom to roam their archive in the sense that we were allowed to do. So I think it was important that right away that they understood what the story we were trying to tell, and they did. And they liked the fact that we were sort of harking back to a slightly different era in the sense of some of the pictures in some of our photo selection. They also liked the fact that we were looking at this material with fresh eyes. I think that was a good thing. I mean, what's interesting about the National Geographic is that it's amazing to think now when everybody says, you know, print is dead, but the story sometimes would run for 60 pages, just photograph and spread after spread, spread after spread. So often we would pick out photos which were maybe published quite small in the original magazine, say from 1954. The way we presented it, it looks totally fresh and unique.
And your coffee table cowers at the prospect of holding that tome. That was Tashin's Ruel Golden speaking to Santiago Tarditi. National Geographic, Around the World in 125 Years, is out now. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Off to explore another very different archive after this.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we're finishing the show today with a trip down to Houston. In the city's museum district sits the Manil campus, anchored by Renzo Piano's first American building. It houses and exhibits the private collection of John and Dominique de Manil, with a focus on contemporary art and surrealism. The space opened in 1987 and includes the early to mid-20th century works of Henri Matisse and Pablo Picasso, alongside an extensive selection of pop and abstract art by Jackson Pollock, Andy Warhol and Mark Rothko. Our Toronto bureau chief Nellie Gotcheva was there recently and met with curator Michelle White, who offered her a rare glimpse of the museum's storage rooms to show her what makes the Manil collection so special.
Well, I think the most important part of our collection in many ways in terms of our recognition even outside of the United States is our holdings of surrealism. We're considered one of the greatest surrealist collections in the world, and it formed out of our founders John and Dominique's de Manil's vision and interest in this period of art history. They were born in France and very much sort of came out of this moment in Paris. So they really started early on collecting surrealists, including Max Ernst, but also de Chirico and Magritte.
Where are we right now? Can you tell me more about the place where we're standing right now?
Sure. We're upstairs on the second floor of the museum, and this is a private space. But what's so incredible about this part of the museum is it's where we keep our collection. So the storage is stored along this corridor in rooms designed to hold the storage. But what makes it really unique in terms of museum design and museum display is that it's visible storage. So the idea is that you can see everything all at once, but also that these rooms are accessible to scholars, to artists, to other curators. But also, more importantly, perhaps, is that Mrs. de Manil, when she was thinking about these spaces with the architect Renzo Piano, was really inspired by the surrealist potential of these rooms. And she always talked about how she wanted the visitor to have a great moment of awe when they entered. So I think you can see when we walk into the rooms that there is something pretty magical that happens when you see everything all at once. So this room is the surrealist room, or early 20th century is housed in this room. So did you have that moment of awe?
It's beautiful. It's pretty.
You can see it's almost like a Wunderkammer. It's all salon-hanged floor to ceiling. And what's fantastic about these rooms, too, is that as a curator and thinking about activating this part of the collection, so none of these works are on view at any one time, but things are always rotating, artworks go out on loan, and one part of my job is thinking about how to organize exhibitions based on our permanent collection holdings. So I spend a lot of time up here thinking about the collection. We display works by artists in groups. So you can see over here, this is an entire wall filled with Mata paintings and drawings. And it's a way to see all of his work at once. If you look at the end of this room, you can see that we have an extraordinary collection of Magritte's. We have over 55 examples of his work. And what was so incredible about the de Manils is they were extremely visionary with who they championed. And René Magritte being one of those artists. In fact, we have this incredible correspondence between the de Manils and Alfred Barr, who was the director of the Museum of Modern Art. And Magritte was having his first exhibition in the United States. And they wrote Barr a letter and they said, "We would like to buy a Magritte for the collection." And Barr comes back and says, "No, I don't really know about René Magritte. I don't think so," and I'm paraphrasing. They go back to Alfred Barr and say, "You know, René Magritte is an artist that we believe in, and we'd like the Museum of Modern Art to have one." And that's the story of one of their earliest acquisitions of Magritte. And I love that they believed in artists. They didn't just buy works by an artist, but they cultivated relationships with artists, and they would support an artist throughout their career. In fact, Max Ernst, they brought Max Ernst to Houston for his first major exhibition in the United States in 1953, which is pretty incredible.
How often do you rotate paintings and artworks that are on display downstairs?
We try to keep things fresh all of the time. So the idea is that for our neighbors, the people that live across the street in this, you know, fantastic neighborhood, is that they can always pop in and see something new. So we don't often rotate the entire permanent collection galleries, but we love, you know, moving works of art in and out. So there's always something new to see.
How long does it take you to put an exhibition together?
Oh, I mean, it all depends on the exhibition. This exhibition I've been working on for about 2.5 years. Other exhibitions have taken as long as 4 years. Another, you know, interesting part about what I do as a curator here is that I'm involved with building this collection. So you can see we're in these rooms full of amazing works of art, but this collection is not stagnant. In fact, since Mrs. de Menil died in 1997, the collection has grown by a third. So we're always thinking about how to expand, how to augment what we have, and how to introduce new contemporary artists into the conversations that the de Menil started so long ago.
That was Michelle White, who's the curator of the Menil Collection in Houston, talking to Nelly Gotcheva. And that's pretty much all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be taking a stroll down to the LA Art Book Fair and enjoying a session from electronic experimenters SAP. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, who was aided by the guru with the metaphorical glue gun, Holly Fisher. Before we go, we have time for one final track from her Midori House session and her new album, Speak a Little Louder. Here is Diane Birch with Walk the Rainbow to the End. Thanks for tuning in.
Come out swinging, my friend. Walk a straight line through the bend. Keep on climbing that hill. Happiness is a sugar pill.
I see your ghost in the in between.